This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Tonight's conversation is about drinking locally, with a focus on the growing brewery and winery presence here in Maryland. And now, I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
This is the fourth program in our series called Origins, which is a speaker series about local food, its origins, and everything that Spike encompasses and what he's doing in all of his restaurants. All right, just going to turn everything right over to Spike.
Here we go. Well, thanks again, everybody, for being here at our Origin Speaker Series. This one, I think, has special interest to a lot of us. We're talking about Maryland-grown and consumed beverages, specifically tonight beer and wine. And I'm really excited to join this group here. We're going to kind of introduce as we go, but the first person I really want to talk to is Kevin Addicks. He has been a longtime director of the Maryland Wineries Association. And Kevin, I'd love for you, if you could, to provide a little bit of the long history of winemaking here in Maryland.
The short version of the long history.
Yes.
Well, it starts in the 1600s. When we have record of colonial folks who were growing grapes in an attempt to replicate what they knew back home. And that started with a gentleman named Tennis Paley and was quickly followed by some other folks who became elected officials, including John Adlam, Samuel Ogle, who was early governor. And it was really John Adlam, who was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson, who helped put Maryland on the map originally for grape growing. And back then they were attempting to grow French vines, importing the French vines, sticking them in the ground. They'd last a few years, and then phylloxera, which is a native louse, would take on the vine, kill it, and then they'd start over. So it was many years later into the 1900s when the modern wine industry began again. We had prohibition and some other very interesting topics in between that we could go on and on about. But it was in the mid-1900s, 1940s, when Philip Wagner, who was a journalist and then editor of the Evening Sun and Baltimore Sun, who brought back with him from his war reporting new clippings, new vines, and some hybrid vines as well that were being developed in France. And he began a grape nursery here called Bordy. And Bordy Vineyards was the first bonded winery in 1945, still the longest operating winery. It's changed hands once from the Wagners to the DeFord family. But that's really where Eastern wine began. And the vines actually made their way all the way to California. Folks at Kenwood Winery and others in Sonoma and Napa first got started off of Bordy vines.
Wow.
So that's the short history.
And here we are, yeah. And that brings us to you, Drew Baker, co-founder and winemaker at Old Westminster. I think one of our newest, but already, I think, a star among Maryland wineries here. Can you give us kind of where you are right now, what got you into winemaking, and kind of the state of the art here in Maryland 2015?
Absolutely. It's great to be here. Old Westminster Winery is my family's attempts to make really noteworthy wines here in Maryland. We're very much the new kids on the block. My sister Lisa is actually the winemaker. I can't take that title. I grow the grapes, and we have a farm in Westminster, Maryland. It's 20 acres, so it's a very small farm. We have 7 acres of vineyard that we established Easter weekend 2011, so it's a very young operation. We also work with a handful of other Maryland grape growers that have really interesting sites in different spots throughout the state, and we are attempting to make some really special wines. We focus on wines European style, dry, interesting. We're trying to make wines that we enjoy drinking, and hopefully they share well with other people. And I hope that 10, 15, 20 years from now, we can look back and see how we were a part of a quality wine renaissance here in Maryland. I think that some really great things are possible here. Sort of the secrets are out. We understand our climate. We understand better the varieties of wines that can be grown here, what can, the styles that really shine. And we're sort of embracing this sort of French style, making wines that are nuanced and interesting and lower alcohol in content. And just it's a really fun time to be a part of local wine.
It's a great time to be drinking local wine, and I want to get back to that. But first, I would like to introduce Tom Barst, the owner and operator of Milk House Brewery at Still Point Farm out in Mount Airy, Maryland. And I think Baltimore in particular has long been known as a hotbed of brewing, historically at least. That may not be the case now, but you are brewing on your farm with farm products from your farm and others, as I understand it. That's kind of what one of the reasons we're so happy to be able to present your beers, especially at Parts and Labor. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening out there at the brewery?
I can, Spike. Thank you, and thank you for inviting me here. I'm glad to be here. We first started growing hops in Maryland. Well, actually, that's not true. I first started brewing beer. I brewed my first beer on March 9th, 1972.
Wow.
So for over 43 years, before it was even legal to homebrew. Of course, it wasn't legal to smoke pot then either. But it got me hooked on brewing, and I kept home brewing, and then it became legal, and you could finally buy home brewing supplies and whatnot, but you could never really get good hops. Mm-hmm. So I planted hops now and then at different locations that I lived throughout the years, and finally Carol Ann and I, my wife, bought this farm in 2008, and the first thing I planted was hops. Second thing I did was buy sheep. So we started a hop yard, a half an acre. And then I expanded to an acre, and I had way too many hops. So I went around to actually Union Mills, the beer festival at Union Mills in Westminster, and carried little bags of hops with me. And I went around to all the brewers, and I handed them out. And about a month later, Hugh Sisson from Heavy Seas called me. He says, "You got any of those hops left?" I said, "Sure I do. I'll come on down." And so he invited me down, and I brought samples of hops. And it was great because he takes them out of the bag and he crushes them in his hand like this, and he holds them up to his nose. He's like, "Oh my God, these are the best hops I've ever seen." And then I told him, "Well, they're $18 a pound." And so we made our first beer in Maryland with Maryland-grown hops. It was a cask of Loose Cannon that was premiered at the Judge's Bench in Ellicott City, and the cask was finished in 43 minutes. At the judgment. So that was pretty cool. And then I've sold them to Flying Dog and Pratt Street Ale House. Steve Jones, who's the brewer there, loves my Chinooks. And I thought, am I going too long here? Just tell me to shut up.
No, you're good.
I thought, I can make more money making beer with my own hops than selling hops to these other brewers. So I went to the county. You know, you go to the county, you want to start something new, and I said, "I'd like to build a brewery. We grow ingredients for beer, and this is like a value-added agricultural product." "No, you can't do that," I was told. So we leaned on them, and there was another brewer and farmer in Frederick County, and we kind of worked together, and the county finally added a farm brewery section to the agricultural zoning ordinance, or to the zoning ordinance in Frederick County. And in their infinite wisdom, decided that if you wanted to sell beer on your farm, that you had to have a commercial liquor license, which you can't get in an agricultural zoning district.
Case closed.
Yeah. So we went to the state, and what my friend Kelly Schultz, and most of us are probably liberals in here, right? Kelly is a diehard Tea Party Republican, and I love her to death because beer is totally nonpartisan, and she was a huge supporter of us. And we mirrored the winery bill that was passed the year before, or maybe 2 years before, and got a new farm brewery manufacturer's license bill passed first time through both houses of the legislature unanimously.
Awesome.
And then signed by the governor in July, and it went into effect July 1st of 2012. we were already building because we knew that we could get the county to do what we needed them to do, and we had a great agricultural economic development guy. His name is Colby Ferguson. He now works for the state. And here we are. And we're making beer and distributing to your establishments.
And we are loving it. In fact, and that brings us to our last person here at the table. Corey Poloka is our director of operations for Woodbury Kitchen, but was hired as a bartender many, many years ago and is really responsible for making the bar programs at Woodbury, Artifact, Parts and Labor, Shoofly, what they are, and was the guy that really kind of brought the local to the Woodbury bar. And it wasn't as much of a no-brainer as I might have thought it would have been back when we started Woodbury in 2007. But Corey, you probably, I think, more of these products probably passed through your hands than almost anybody else in the city. And I'd love to get your perspective before we open this conversation up to what that's like to be running a bar program in a restaurant like Woodbury that's featuring, you know, wines from Drew and beers from Tom.
Well, I know when we first started the bar programs, we were really off track with what the chefs were doing in the kitchen. And about 6 months in, Spike looked at me and said, "When is the bar going to get on board with what we're doing?" And I was like, "I guess today."
good answer.
Yeah. And it started with wine, and we had local wine on the list, and we were pouring it. At that time, not a lot in the restaurant. It was overshadowed, I think, by the rest of the world. And we started focusing on it and, I think, developing language. And then we were starting to think about how to use it, too, in cocktails, which I think was a new thing for Maryland wine. We did some great sangrias. We were doing, like, New York sours that had red wine. And it was easy to say, like, if we're going to use wine in a cocktail, it's only going to be Maryland wine. They were great. They kind of ran the range of from sweet to dry, depending on what you needed, which was important in drinks. And we started there. And then as the program kind of went on, we started looking at other things to use that were from Maryland in drinks. Spirits are one, but beer became one that we used in placing soda water. And I remember when we were making fizzes and flips and things, it was only using Maryland beer, which at that time wasn't, the imports for it weren't necessarily grown here until we've come across a couple of new guys. And that was a big step for us in the bar program. And again, helped kind of establish why we were doing these drinks and what they tasted like if they were made and grown in the Mid-Atlantic, which I was really excited about. And then we repeated it when we did Artifact, and then Shoofly focuses a lot on wine. We do it in everything from alcoholic slushes to just great wines by the glass. And Parts and Labor focuses on farm beer. When we built it, we weren't sure we wanted to go with beer, but I knew this law just passed. I'd heard about your brewery, and I said, well, we're going to pour farm beer and feature it and get the city drinking it and then balance it with other East Coast beers, and I think Jace now is doing a good job with that. And then a new one will be Grand Cru, and we're excited to focus on really being strong retailers of wine and beer and then also mixing with it in the area. So,
great. Thanks for that. And I want to open the conversation up certainly to anybody that wants to join in. Now that I think we know who we have here at the table, Dana has a microphone that can make its way to anybody that wants one. But I'm going to start things off. I might be considered a little bit of a partisan when it comes to these issues. So I want to challenge our guests here, maybe starting with you, Kevin. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I guess you can say that Maryland wines haven't had a great reputation recently, and I think that may be starting to change. But how would you answer someone that said, you know, wines from Maryland, is the quality there? Is it really worth it?
Well, I have this conversation daily. There was a reporter whose name I will not mention, called yesterday from Southern Living. He also writes for Savoir Magazine and some other big publications, and essentially prefaced his question. His end question was, give me the name of a good Maryland wine. But his preface was 19 minutes. I didn't have a chance to respond to him about how local wine, it's not about local wine. It's about, you know, great wines of the world, and it's not about trying to grow things and trying to grow things well or committing to local product because it's all going to be bad unless it's from France, blah, 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 blah. Give me the name of a good winery. And I think that you get that on a local basis. Whenever you have a wine event or a tasting, you know, you have someone come up and they're like, what are you pouring? And you say Maryland, and you see the folks who are committed to local and they're willing to try it, and you can explain it and they'll get it and they'll understand it. And as Drew said, a large part of the industry is focused on growing good grapes, making wine from those grapes, and being committed to the variations in the climate and the learning that happens. But you have to get customers to come along. Very often, you talk to folks who've tried Maryland wine, tried it 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I can't think of another product category where people can do this, but they'll try a wine 20 years ago, not like it, write it off completely, never try it again. And I can't think of that. I can't think of another example of that. You know, you may still wander into that store you bought a bad shirt from 15 years later just to give it a shot, new branding, whatever. But with wine, you do see people write it off, and they can't believe that something good could come from a local vine. And I think that with folks like Drew, Black Ankle, you know, I can think of probably a dozen wineries in the state. We've got 70 now, and there's a dozen that are, you know, Bordy is another example where they're revising how they do things. They just won Best Cabernet Franc in a major national wine competition with major national wines in that competition. So that's great to be able to point to that. So it's my job to help promote the concept, but it's Drew's job to make the good stuff.
So what about that, Drew? You're playing with, it seems like you want to be, you know, up there with the big boys, right? You guys are trying to make wine that will stand up to wines from California and around the world. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And
I think we are. We can.
Good.
I think the future's bright.
Uh-huh.
Because of the challenges from a climatic standpoint here in the Mid-Atlantic, particularly rain. There's a frost warning tonight, which I'll probably lose a lot of sleep over. But because of certain challenges, I think creating high volumes of product will be a challenge. I don't think that we can create wines on a global scale in terms of volume. But what I think that we can do is make really fantastic small lot wines. And that's what we're focusing on doing. We're making lots of wines that are vineyard-specific, site-specific, wines that reflect the place that they're grown and really highlight, hopefully, the best that the Mid-Atlantic can offer. And I think that is sort of a high bar that we're setting for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And like Kevin said, there's dozens of other wineries that I could list quickly in Virginia, in Maryland, in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, that are making some really, really awesome wines. And it's true that Maryland has had a bad rep for a long time, and I can personally say that I've had tons of wines from Maryland that are really poorly made. But I don't think that is Maryland's fault. it's not the fault of the soils. You know, like I said at the beginning, I think that if people have a good site and they understand how to farm it, and they do so thoughtfully, and they put lots of effort in the cellar, some really great products can be made.
So Corey, I walk into Woodbury and I ask you for a glass of wine. You suggest the Maryland wine to me. What's my typical response? Typical response from a guest?
As quickly as, no, I want something else. Sometimes, though, because of selling the wine in a restaurant at a restaurant price point, people say $16.50 for a glass of Maryland wine, when we have other wines around the world that can be cheaper. I think we were failing when we were doing it that way. I think what we started to shift a little bit to now is not leading with, like, this is a Maryland wine all the time, but just saying, like, here's a really great now Albarino or something like that. And then you kind of take the Maryland context out of it for a second and let the person try the wine, and they're like, this is a really great wine. Where's it from? Oh, right down the road. And that's always a special, I always enjoy that moment.
Call that gift with purchase, right?
Yeah.
And that's great. But Tom, you're talking about tops for $18 a pound?
Yeah.
Is that even possible in this?
Oh, yeah. I'm the president of the Northeast Hop Alliance, which is a fairly large agricultural organization. We have growers from North Carolina to Quebec. We have about 650 members in our organization, and we're up to about 300 acres of hops growing in the East now. But to put that in perspective, New York, Madison County, New York, alone in the 1880s and 90s produced 21 million pounds.
Wow.
So we used to produce a lot of hops in the East, and Maryland farmers produced about 10% of the hops that Maryland brewers needed in the 1890s. And then we got downy mildew and powdery mildew and didn't know how to treat them. And then Prohibition happened, and that put the nail in the last coffin, even in New York. I think the last hop production facility closed in 1953 in New York State. So we started all over again.
Uh-huh.
And all those records are gone. I mean, there is a little museum in Madison County, New York, you know, the Hop Museum, but there's no information in it. I mean, there's no technical information. And all the stuff from out west is wrong for us.
Right.
we have different disease pressure, we have different soil, different, all kinds of different issues. So hops in the East are not part of the commodity market that hops are in the West. Instead, we have the we have small growers. It's more like the Central European hop farm, where we have a lot of small growers who can sell directly, individually to brewers. We can make that special one-off relationship with a brewer who wants to brew a harvest ale or whatever, and we do quite a bit of that all up and down the East. And East Coast hops taste and smell different than West Coast hops. We made a beer recently called Smash, a single malt, single hop ale, pale ale, with all Cascade hops from my farm. And it's fabulous. And you're like, those are really, people drink it, those are Cascades? I'm like, yeah, but they're Maryland Cascades. So we have a special crop. We're small farmers who have a small cash crop. And East Coast brewers are willing to pay a premium to get local hops because local is important. It's an important marketing tool for brewers. They may not make a lot of beer with local hops, but those one-off beers that they make, for example, Flying Dog every year makes a harvest ale they call Secret Stash. Mm-hmm. Last year they made 200 barrels. It was sold in 3 weeks. Gone in 3 weeks. The first year we did it, which I think was 4 or 5 years ago, they made 50 barrels, and it was gone in 3 weeks as well. And so they doubled production every year since they started that beer. And they not only use local hops, but they use a lot of other local ingredients from the Mid-Atlantic.
That was the question I wanted to ask. Ness, I might ask you, Kevin, mm-hmm. how many acres do we have under grapevines in Maryland right now?
We have roughly, we're just doing a survey as we speak of the many new independent growers and wineries are adding more each year. Uh-huh. We have between 1,600 and 1,800 acres all throughout the state. As Drew said, we're still learning. The secrets are out, but we're still learning. Like we 3 or 4 years ago thought that Syrah would be a great grape for Maryland, and Drew is shaking his head because it froze out. It died with the last two winters in most parts of the state. So we are still learning, and we're replanting, and you know, I mentioned a few wineries that are replanting based on new best practices. They had vines, 20, 30-year-old vines, but we now know better. We know a lot better.
What are you planting, Drew?
We're planting more Albarino this spring, 2,000 more vines. It's a bit more winter hardy. Uh-huh. Really, the winter of 2013 changed a lot. It was the coldest, longest winter that we've had in my lifetime, but I've heard longer than that. And there's a lot of varieties that turned out to be not particularly cold hardy. And Syrah is a great example. Merlot, to a lesser extent, everyone thought Merlot was the Mid-Atlantic workhorse, uh-huh. and it's not. So we're really discovering that varieties like Albarino, Cabernet Franc, Chardonnay, it's pretty widely planted around the world, but it does particularly well here. Sauvignon Blanc is okay. You know, there's just certain varieties that we are planting more of. And part of what I think that we do well in the Mid-Atlantic can do well is creating wines from multiple different varieties. I think that it, you know, given sort of the climatic variation that we have year to year, it's important not to put all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. Grow lots of different wines, and inevitably you have better years for certain varieties than others. But we are able to consistently use everything that we produce and create wines that we're really proud of. So that's the important part.
Yeah. Tom, what other inputs? You talked about hops. What else are you able to get into your beers?
We grow wheat. I mean, we're a farm, and so we use in the farmhouse that's here today that has some of our wheat, and we have an apiary that has some of our honey in it as well. It has a little bit of, there's a secret ingredient. I wasn't going to tell you, but I will. It's a little bit of chamomile. That's the little tiny spice. You're like, what's in this beer? Uh-huh. And so we play with our beer, and we also we use sometimes we get wild yeast, collect wild yeast to put in our beers. We make a lot of one-offs. I recently made a beer. Don't tell anybody that we barrel.
You know this has been recorded, right?
That we barrel aged in a Moonshiners Sour Mash Corn Whiskey Barrel. and it was so delicious. So I'm looking for legal moonshiners, because this sour mash corn whiskey barrel aged double IPA was just unbelievable. And I only made one cask. I'm working on a... Do I have time just to tell one more little story?
Yeah.
Matt Brophy from Flying Dog and I are working with Rick Wassman from Copper Fox Distillery, which is over the line in Sperryville. Worth the trip, by the way, if you like whiskey. And we're going to do a collaboration using malt from Copper Fox. They malt all of their own barley. Mm-hmm. They have a beautiful malting operation there, and all of the barley is grown in the Northern Neck in Virginia. Mm-hmm. So we're using their malt and my hops, and we're making a portion of the beer will be their apple and cherrywood smoked malt. So it's sort of on the line, along the lines of a Scottish ale, and we'll use probably a Scottish ale yeast. It's not a Scottish ale, but it should be delicious. So I'll let you know when it comes out.
Looking forward to that, yeah.
Yeah, really. Wow.
And so we're trying to get as more and more local. I was just contacted by Pilot Malting in Michigan. They're looking for someone to work with here to start a local malt house. So I have farmer friends who would like to grow malting barley, but there's no place to send it to have it malted at a reasonable price. So we're working to bring it all right here.
That's, I mean, and so much of what I think what we focus on at Woodbury is how this gets back to the, you know, to the into the food system, into the agriculture of our state. And I guess I'm wondering, is this, are we ever going to be able to move the needle? Do you guys think what we're doing here with this, you know, you talk about 1,800 acres under vine, right? And we're coming along, you've got a couple acres of hops, and you know, we're a state that's principally devoted its agriculture to commodities, corn and soy, mostly almost exclusively as animal feed. And I'm really interested, you know, we think about Woodbury and what we're doing there with our food. We're constantly thinking about the people that are growing our food and what are the consequences of their practices. And this is part of that, right? Do you think we can make a difference here? I'm going to ask you, Kevin, with the agriculture in this state.
I do. I've also recently started working with the local breweries and the local distilleries. And when you broaden it to distilling as well, a lot of those same crops that we use, that we grow now for animal feed, can be of much higher value mm-hmm. if you put it into a distilled product. And same thing, if we were able to land a full-scale malting house here in Maryland, then think of how many acres you could switch right away.
And so farmers get a premium for malting barley.
Yeah, way more than you would for any other commodity use. So I do think it's possible.
And so we've got grapes, we've got hops, we've got malting barley and other grains. Can these be considered low input crops? As I understand it, we can't do any of this organically. Is that true?
No, that's not true at all. Black locust hops in Baltimore County, Freeland, are exclusively organic. In Maryland, there's another grower in Allegheny County, Organarchy. Hops are totally organic. They have great production. They're making it happen. So, and the law changed last year. If a brewer wants to make organic beer, even your hops have to be organic now. It used to be, because it was such a small ingredient, that it didn't matter. You could call your beer organic even if you used normally produced hops. But now you even have to use organically produced hops.
How about grapes?
It depends what you're growing. If you're growing Native American vines, some French American hybrids, there are varieties that require far less input than what we're growing. We are growing exclusively vinifera or vines of European descent, French vines essentially, and I know no example of anyone in the Mid-Atlantic that is successfully growing them organically. Particularly, downy mildew is a major problem. Black rot on fruit set. That said, we grow very thoughtfully. We don't have a generic spray program where we're out there every Wednesday spraying certain things just because it's Wednesday again. We are very hands-on in the vineyard. We're scouting. We're observing pressure.
and we act accordingly. Everything that we are 90% organic, but there's Japanese beetle pressure. Once a year, we need to address that. With black rot at flowering, once a year, we need to address that. So I would say that it's very minimal, mm-hmm. But not certifiably organic.
Right. And I think that was. You know, I've heard people kind of dismiss it out of hand, grape growing in Maryland, wine production in Maryland. But when you look at it compared to a lot of other things that we do, it's very low input. It's very high value, right? I mean, when you look at wine grapes. So it makes all the sense in the world to me if we can find somebody to make good wine, which I think we finally, like you said, that wasn't really Maryland's fault as much as, I don't know, what was going on.
Just a learning curve.
Yeah.
And one thing I'd add to the sustainability discussion, when you talk about any crop, you need to look at it in a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking just of a commodity grain crop, you're tilling it every year. Even if you're not tilling it, there's a whole expanse of time where it is bare.
Right.
And when it does rain, it does run off. As opposed to a vineyard or a hop yard where you do have buffers and you've got, you know, green zones around it, you don't till. It's a much greener on the spectrum practice than a lot of things that we're doing elsewhere in agriculture.
And it's growing, and that's a great thing. A second ago, Kevin had talked about the current acreage in Maryland that's under vine, and I know of 70 acres that are being planted within 10 miles of our farm this spring. So it's growing rapidly, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it's a lot to be. That is good news. Anybody have any? We've got amazing panelists here. Yeah.
I have a question that Kevin, Drew, or even Corey could probably answer. I mean, I have an opinion, but I was wondering what you guys thought with New York's state grape being Riesling and Virginia being Viognier. What would you say is the signature grape for Maryland? If somebody wanted a true taste of Maryland, which grape really stands out the best from here?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer for it. Kevin does.
Is it not Saval? I don't know.
No?
I hope it's not.
Kevin has an answer, of course. Please do.
Red blend.
Okay, for me, I always thought and still do that Cab Franc is grown best here than anywhere else. Any Cab Franc I've tasted from anywhere else, I always think the Maryland really stands up and offers a lot with fruit and spice and really is just a full example of what Maryland can do best.
I think Cabernet Franc is a great option. We grow more Cabernet Franc than any other red grape. It is the largest portion of everything that we do. But like Kevin said, I think that it's really best blended in a lot of scenarios. Cabernet Franc is sort of like rustic and old world and earthy, and it's really delicious. But there's a lot of other varieties like Cabernet Sauvignon or Petit Verdot that sort of bring like some strength to the blend, and Merlot can bring like some really nice fruit. And when you blend wines, you can really create wines that offer something that is greater than the sum of the parts. And very rarely in winemaking in the cellar do we go through and taste barrels and say, like, oh, that barrel tasting was perfect. There's nothing that I could ever do to that to make it any better. And when we grow different things, it really gives us options to put together wines that really sing.
On the restaurant side, I think I've been selling wine for a while and study the wines in the world. You tend to think of great wine-growing regions and the cuisine there and then how to put it together. And I always remember a white and a red, and if I'm lucky, a rosé. So a lot of times now I find myself selling Albarino because it's great with the Chesapeake Bay oyster. And I think if we can establish those links between the beverages we have and the food that is very strong in Maryland, I think you'll see some clear winners emerge when it comes to wine.
No, I agree. Thanks.
I know in the past, even decade, it's moved from a handful of Maryland wineries, especially, to, I think you said 70 today, Kevin. What are some of the biggest, legislatural issues that you guys have faced? I know Tom mentioned with hops that he was facing an issue where on the county level they were blocking him, but what are some of the major legislatural issues that are holding you guys up that have held you back so far?
Thank you. I would say that a lot of the challenges that we had that helped keep the industry from growing in the 90s and early 2000s, we were able to fix in 2010. The Maryland Winery Modernization Act was a Herculean effort to get that passed through the legislature, but passed through the first guard, which is the lobbyists representing the other segments of the industry, which are always concerned about turf and making sure that when you start to grow the local wine industry, does that somehow impact their business negatively? We were able to pass that law, which had some major allowances production-wise but also marketing-wise. But before the law passed, if you visited a winery, you were not allowed to taste or buy anything unless you took a physical walking guided tour through the winery. And then only then were you allowed to buy wine, and still only one quart per person, per brand, per year. And that law finally succumbed when the state realized that it doesn't even allow quarts of product to be sold since 1938. So we were illegal anyway. Now the challenges are really with marketing. How do we get, as Drew mentioned, as Corey mentioned, when you remove Maryland from the pitch and you pour this wine and you get it into someone's mouth and they're really surprised by how good whatever this wine is actually is, and then you surprise them and say Maryland, then you've got a Maryland wine fan. It's the same thing with beer, although God bless the beer lovers, they just love beer. And if they can get local beer, they love it, and there's no sales pitch to be had. They go in and ask for local beer, and that's what we're trying to do, is get our wineries to be able to go out to farmers markets, where you have folks who are predisposed to buying local, let them try it, and then they become believers. So we've got some additions to that law to allow more market access.
Could I piggyback on that?
Absolutely.
I think the importance of the Modernization Act that got passed in 2010 can't be understated. One of the big provisions that it allows wineries to now do is what is called an alternating proprietorship, which sounds fancy, but it's basically just renting space. It's allowing another wine facility, winemaker, to help you make wine. And at Old Westminster Winery, there are now 7 wineries making wine, and we're actively expanding our winery because it's bursting at the seams. My sister is a really fantastic winemaker, and she's made some great wines right out of the gate. And as a result, there's a lot of other folks that have always been interested, dreamed of having a winery. They have a farm. They want to do something with it. But the idea of planting a vineyard and farming it and then building a winery, this big industrial building, and then learning everything there is to know about making wine, it's exorbitantly expensive. And what this law really did was lowered the bar to entry. Now people can plant a vineyard, or they can buy grapes from another local source, and they can bring them to Old Westminster Winery, or there's a couple other wineries that are now doing it, and they can have their wines made. They can be a part of the process, but they're not solely responsible for the whole thing. And then they can create their own farm brand. And a couple of years ago, that was completely impossible, and now it is. And as a result, there's a lot of people coming into the industry. There's a lot of interest, and we really need to get to a point where there's a certain number of wineries. We need a critical mass, and we're really approaching.
Okay. Just.
And I guess, you know, my perception is that when we started out way back when, Maryland, Virginia were almost on par. This would be early 90s. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Maryland just went nowhere, and we had the same handful of wineries for the next decade or for longer, and Virginia just took off. And it has to be, you know, the states realize, I think, at a certain point that this has value, and in all these different ways. What do you say to that, or, you know, around beer? Because it feels like we were also kind of a little late to the party.
Similar problems. Breweries had similar problems that the wineries had.
Uh-huh.
For example, Heavy Seas or Flying Dog, you had to do, in order for you to taste the beer and to buy a beer at the brewery, you had to do a tour, and you were allowed to buy one case per person, not just of every brand, one case per person per year at the brewery. And you couldn't sell the samples. You could charge a fee for the tour. And then you could let people sample all your brands and then do the tour, and then you could sell one case of beer.
Hell of a model.
So, a hell of a model. And the breweries were allowed to distribute an unlimited amount of their own beer, but most breweries don't want to also own a fleet of trucks, so that none of them did in Maryland. One of the problems a small brewery has, a problem that we have, is that we can't afford to use a commercial distributor. And when we first got our farm brewery license, we weren't allowed to distribute our own beer. So we were doing fine at the brewery. I mean, it's a beautiful place. You all have to come out to Milk House Brewery and have a beer with me, because it is a beautiful place, as is Drew's Winery. But we want people kept asking, when are you going to bring your beer to my store? Right. Spike, you're an inspiration, by the way. So you have started this whole thing going on here. Anyway, not just here in Baltimore, but around the state. So there's new restaurants, and I know you know who they are, that are doing not the same thing or similar things, but they're focusing on local, and I really, really appreciate what you've done. But we got a new law passed last July that lets me distribute up to 3,000 barrels of wine. If I ever make 3,000 barrels of beer, just shoot me. But that's a lot of beer, for me anyway. And I can make a living distributing beer myself, and I run it around in my pickup truck. You may have seen me pull up and I carry the kegs out myself, and it's a pain. If anybody's looking for work, but that really helped us a lot. So those problems, and there are still problems. I would love for Drew to be able to sell his wine at my brewery, and I'd love to be able to sell my beer at his brewery. I'd love to be able to have a wine and beer festival, which we can't do. But we're working on it, aren't we, Kevin?
Yes, we are.
So there's still problems that will help. If we get them fixed, it will continue to help us with our marketing and educating the public about our products.
I don't remember your name, but the winery, you.
Drew.
Yeah, Drew. Do you buy grapes from other vineyards?
We do.
And are you looking at where they are? I mean, I know Maryland, dark and miniature, there are different climates, different terroirs. So are you looking, when you planted, were you looking at maybe what your soil and climate was? Did you look at other places in the world to see what they were growing and what might be comparable to what you were going to do?
Yes, to all the above.
Yeah. And tell me about where you think yours is similar to.
I think that fundamentally all the great wine sites in the world, the real key is to have well-drained soils. Grapes do not like wet feet. They like soils that are rocky and drain away. That said, Chardonnay is grown in a lot of places around the world, so it's a really good example of a grape that reflects where it's grown. And Chardonnay from Chablis could not be more different than Chardonnay from California or Chardonnay from Maryland or you name another place. So the point being that it really reflects where it's grown, and our job is to plant Chardonnay and other varieties on good sites that are well suited and farm them according to our particular place and our particular climate and create something that is delicious to drink and reflects where it came from. So I would say that we're not necessarily trying to be like fill in the blank with the French wine region. We're just trying to make wines that really reflect our little unique place well. You mentioned that Maryland is a really interesting state because if you drive 50 miles in any direction, you're in like a different place. And for that reason, it's really fun for us because we work with growers from the Elk Neck Peninsula in Cecil County all the way out to the foothills on the west side of South Mountain. And these are very different places. We get different varieties. In some situations, we have the same variety, like Merlot, grown on opposite ends of the state. And it's really fun for us to play with these different pieces, puzzle pieces in the winery. Like I said before, this really gives us some interesting options at the blending table. And then we really make a lot of we make wines that are either single vineyard designations and or regional blends. So we kind of do some different things, and that's the fun of it. When you're a really small producer, we make on average less than 100 cases of any particular wine. It allows us to do things different, and I think that our model is interesting to people that drink adventurously, because you're not going to get the same wine year in and year out. So it's bad for building a world scale conglomerate, but it's really great for people that just like to drink interesting things.
I think, you know, for us at Woodbury, we're so insanely focused on trying to create the actual authentic flavor of this place. And I think, you know, for me, one of the exciting things is that I don't know if there was any... Is there a requirement for Maryland wineries to use Maryland grapes, or is that...
There are two requirements. So the biggest requirement, the universal requirement, is for a wine to be labeled Maryland. That's a federal law.
Uh-huh.
Has to be 75% Maryland fruit.
Uh-huh.
Gets a little higher if you're going to label it. With a grape name, it gets and you can play around with it. So we do have wineries that bring in fruit from, like I'll use Cygnus Wine Cellars in Manchester.
Uh-huh.
Local to him is Pennsylvania,
uh-huh.
Right? It's 5 minutes that way, where the next grower is 25 minutes away. So he gets local grapes there, blends them in. So sometimes we have a Maryland winery producing a Pennsylvania labeled wine. So it's what we like about the federal law is it's full disclosure. Mm-hmm. So you can pick up a bottle and see where it's from.
Right.
There is a state law that says that a Maryland winery must use local grapes if they're available. So if supply meets demand, and it hasn't been up to now, but we're getting to a point where, some point pretty soon that law is going to close down. And local wineries are going to have to use local fruit. The ones that Drew's mentioning, and I'll say this. We run two wine competitions in the state,
uh-huh.
Governor's Cup, which is restricted to Maryland-grown fruit. And then we run a Wine Master's Choice, which is any wine made in Maryland. And the first couple of years, we were nervous that wine made from fruit not from Maryland was going to win. It's never even come close, which is always interesting to me, that the better wines made in Maryland are from Maryland fruit. And so I think that kind of points to what we're doing here and kind of the new edition of Maryland wine.
That's great to hear. You know, we have this, recently there was a study or a report done about Maryland crab cakes, and
yes.
we very firmly believe that a Maryland crab cake should be made with Maryland crab meat, and apparently there are many people that don't quite share that opinion, but I think that, a true taste of the place is going to come from wines that are made with Maryland fruit, beers that are made with Maryland hops and Maryland
grain,
yeah, maybe some Maryland honey, Maryland chamomile, I guess. Word's out. I would just like to know, I think we've done a great job of kind of painting the picture of where we are right now. What do you guys see as next for this state and what we're doing with wine, with beer, restaurants? God knows.
You want me to tell anybody?
It's an uphill battle. Yeah, maybe we should start with you. I don't know.
Well, I wanted to jump on one thing with maybe what's next. So your new branding is out, and I think it looks really good, and it'll look good in some of the retail. But with Maryland in place and wine, I think I'd like to see maybe a little bit more of an interest on it from wineries, because you're getting grapes from all over the place. I saw your new labels now, and they look really nice.
Thanks.
But providing more information, I think, to the guests or to someone like me that's selling wine is helpful. It's something that we can latch on to. Like, you're now talking about South Mountain, which someone in Maryland might not even know where that is. Someone that's buying a Maryland wine might not know why it's important. And I think, some of the great wineries in the world talk about their appellations and their regions, and I don't think we do a great job of that on the consumer or selling side. So I'd be interested in that as someone that sells your products. And on the restaurant side, I think you guys know what Spike and I are focused on. It's just building more places that support what all these great growers and artisans and people do, because we all kind of rise, I think, together with it. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, with beer, and not just farm breweries, because even among the farm breweries that exist, there are three open now, I think. and soon there will be two more. And then within a year, I think there's going to be probably eight or nine in the state. But among all breweries, we have, you know, like you Flying Dog, the Gonzo beer, Heavy Seas, the pirate beer. Breweries have, you know, they have a marketing thing. You know, if it wasn't for Hunter S. Thompson and who's the artist? Ralph Steadman for Flying Dog, you'd never recognize their beer. And Hugh Sisson changed their brand drastically, you know, 5 or 6 years ago and created the Heavy Seas branding. Actually had a contest with his employees to do the artwork. Everybody submit a cartoon, you know, and we'll turn it into a label. The farm breweries are emphasizing different things. Linganore Winery has opened, or the, a new brewery has, farm brewery has opened at Linganore Winery called Red Shedman. And they're right down the street from me. And they make totally different beers than I make. And we've gotten much busier since they opened, and they've gotten busy because we're open. And anyway, my beers are completely different than his, and they're very nice beers. They're just different. We now have Jailbreak Brewing in Laurel, and their beers are completely different than everybody else's. So breweries emphasize different things to help their marketing thing. I think now the way our Maryland wine, and by the way, I only buy Maryland wine. I only drink Maryland wine. And I drink a lot of it, and Fred Wilson is a rich man because of it. No, but so we have to do the same kind of thing. You know, breweries are now, you know, it's not real competitive yet, because every time a brewery opens, we all get a little bit busier. We educate the public a little bit more, and we get more customers. So we hope that keeps going on. 70 wineries.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
I just had a marketing question. Does Maryland consume everything that you guys make?
Consumes everything I make.
And I consume a fair amount.
I mean, is the market...
God only knows.
Tom is doing
the market is completely local?
The market is local. Maryland wineries can ship wine out of state to 42 states. I think they ship a small percentage of their product out of state. But most is consumed in-state. And an interesting fact is, if most of it's consumed in-state, that's still only 2.8% of all of the sales and consumption in Maryland for wine. So of all wine sold, Maryland's 2.8%.
And in beer, most of the breweries are actually brew pubs who sell all of their beer at their location on site. Our beer is sold in the city and I think five other counties. In Maryland, we're having a hard time keeping up. I'll be honest with you.
I know that for a fact. We're always looking for more milk house, right, Jace?
Yeah.
All right, good. Drew, next at Westminster.
We're growing just as quickly as we can.
Just you're building a tasting room, right?
We are. It's under construction now. Hopefully, it will be open in September. That's the goal. You know how I don't know that there's ever been a construction project that's ahead of schedule, but we're working just as fast as we can. This past fall, we signed a contract with a beautiful vineyard on a great limestone hillside just south of Hagerstown, and that is almost 14 acres. So this coming fall, we will be working with all that fruit at our winery.
Wow,
and
so it's planted. It's already a vineyard.
Yes.
And what's in there?
Just about, you name it.
Wow.
Everything is of French variety. So all the Bordeaux varieties, some Chardonnay, some Viognier. They grow some Gruner Veltliner and some other funky things. So it'll be really fun to work with.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and that will help us to double our production again this coming year, which is going to be really important for us. And then other than that, we're making a lot of wine for other folks too. And that demand for that seems to be growing pretty quickly, which is an exciting thing. And I think it's a great sign, sort of like this groundswell that's happening right now. And as long as we can make great wines for ourselves and for other people, then it will help us help the industry have more brands that are making marketable product. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we're making wine for other people, that's good for us and it's good for the industry too.
Sounds
same thoughts on where this all is going from here.
Well, I think that we've come from a time when wineries and breweries opened up and tried to scale. They tried to get big. They tried to make more of fewer products and get those distributed and get them everywhere and on every tap and on every shelf. What I'm seeing in both industries and also in distilling is that there's a push to be more, even more local, hyper-local, to make the best product you can from the most local ingredients. And sometimes that pushes the price up, but you're going to see Maryland Chenin Blanc. You're going to see, I just yesterday tried Maryland Pinot Blanc and Dolcetto, grown in Allegheny County, reliably, even through the hard frost. So I think you're going to see more interesting, very, very local. Bad for you, probably hard to find, you know, much smaller production. But when you get it, it's a score. I mean, uh-huh. It's going to be a great thing because someone like Drew is making it. So
that's we love that hunt, and we love finding those things when we do. Well, I just want to thank you guys for what I thought was a great conversation. I learned something. I hope you guys did as well. I always come away from these things kind of informed and inspired, but most of all kind of hungry and in this case thirsty. So to that end, we have a great a meal for everybody with great Maryland wines and beers, of course, along with it. And let's just join me, please, in thanking our panelists here.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifact for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Lou Mann, Mark Eldridge, Dennis Greensfelder, and Dakota Keaton from the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.